We'll hear argument next to number 95-1225, United States versus Marion Brockcamp. Mr. Wallace.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, in these companion cases, a divided panel of the Court of Appeals held that equitable tolling may be applied to enlarge or suspend the statutory periods that limit the time for filing and the amount of recovery that may be had on tax refund claims. As we recount in our brief, recent decisions of the First, Fourth, Tenth, and Eleventh Circuits have held to the contrary. Our submission is that those four circuits reach the result that is required by the text of the interrelated statutory provisions that govern here, and I would like to turn to the statutory text now, which is set out at pages 2 to 4 of the government's brief. And we start with the last of the provisions that set out section 7422A of the Internal Revenue Code, which the term before last in United States against Williams, this court referred to as a provision that requires administrative exhaustion.
This is found on page 4.
On page 4 of the government's brief in the gray cover. And it says that no suit or proceeding shall be maintained in any court, skipping down until for a refund, until a claim for refund or credit has been duly filed with the secretary according to the provisions of law in that regard. And the controlling provisions, in our view, are those set forth on the preceding two pages, the various provisions of section 6511 of the Internal Revenue Code. And that section starts off in subsection A with a statement of a period of limitation on filing a refund claim with the Internal Revenue Service. For present purposes, since a tax return is required for an income tax, the claim must be filed within 3 years from the time the return was filed or 2 years from the time the tax was paid.
Can I ask you what might be an irrelevant question on that point but would help with my understanding of the statute? Apparently, in their brief on page 18, it did say, as first enacted, it said it's within 3 years from the time the return was required to be filed. And when you read the statute, that same thing came up, I think, last year, you know, in a different case. And I've never been able to understand the statute for that reason.
In the Lundy.
And they
case.
Left those words, was required, out. And then it seems as if you could file a return like 82 years later. And 82 years later, now it's not too late, and they start the statute running, but the grab back only goes back 2 or 3 years. Now
what you get these things amended for us, Mr. Wallace, so they can make some sense.
Well, that's not part of the duties that I have, but the government is looking into the possibility of statutory amendment. The question you posed...
Wasn't there a provision offered for amending this very...
There hasn't actually been a provision offered. There was an announcement that a provision was being prepared for offering, but it still has not been offered.
Is it still being prepared?
It's under study. I'm not privy to the discussions. There are inherent difficulties in addressing this question because of the massive number of returns that are filed every year, difficulties that we've referred to.
Was it just an accident they left out the words were required, or was required, or was some purpose going on that I can't understand?
We don't really have an answer to that. There was So far as I'm aware, no explanation of why this change occurred in the text. This is a question that in the Lundy case last term, the court found no occasion to reach, and it seldom makes a difference because it can make a difference only if in a one-year period, because either you can go back 3 years from when the return was filed to see to ask for refunds of taxes paid during those 3 years, or else 2 years after the tax was paid. And usually with a really late filed return, no taxes were paid within the 3 years or the 2 years, and it makes no difference, as it makes no difference in either of the cases before us. In any event, let me proceed now to the next provision, and for our purposes, the more important provision, subsection B, which appears on page 3 of the government's brief. And it starts off with a subsection 1, which states quite unequivocally the consequences if the claim is not filed within the prescribed period, no credit or refund shall be allowed. It's hard to see that provision has much purpose other than to emphasize the strictness of the filing requirements. And as we point out on page 20 of our brief, this point is re-emphasized in another provision of the code, section 6514A1, which states that any credit or refund which the service actually gives on a claim that is filed after the expiration of these statutory periods of limitation is, quote, erroneous and, quote, considered void. And it's interesting that in the implementing regulation for that provision, section 6514, the service, after tracking the language of the statute, then has a cross-reference to the provisions authorizing suit by the government to recover erroneous refunds. But the next subsection seems to us to be what I might refer to as the clincher, the most dispositive obstacle to the respondents in the Ninth Circuit's position in this case. And that is subsection 2 of subsection B, which is captioned limit on the amount of credit or refund that can be given. And I cannot emphasize too strongly that these caps on the disbursement that can be made from the Federal Treasury have their own express limitation. While there is a cross-reference to the claims limitation period for purpose of separating categories of claims, there is no cross-reference to the claims limitation for purpose of defining the cap itself. It says in subsection A, for example, the amount of credit or refund shall not exceed the portion of the tax paid within a period defined right in this provision, equal to 3 years plus the period of any extension of time for filing the return. And in subsection B, it's the same thing, that the amount of credit or refund shall not exceed the portion of the tax paid during the 2 years immediately preceding the filing of the claim. These are substantive limitations on disbursements from the Treasury that are authorized.
Mr. Wallace, can I ask you a general... Assume we agree with all of your arguments and that it's too late to file a claim and the taxpayer, or this person, who's not really a taxpayer, I guess, has no right to get the money back. Is there anything in the code that would allow the Internal Revenue Service, when presented with facts as extreme as they are in this case, to say, gee, we're not entitled to this $7,000, we want to give it back? Is there anything that allows the government to give back money they know they're not entitled to?
There is not, Justice Stevens. The government can decide not to oppose a private bill in Congress if the facts warrant it, which
they probably would
might more. Well, it depends on which case you're talking about. We've got two cases here, and I'll get into the facts a little bit more. Perhaps the Webb case, which is being held on petition from the Fourth Circuit, is one where there's more clearly been a finding in the state courts in related litigation about precisely what happened, so that there is less room for questioning the factual accuracy of a look-back affidavit about what someone's capacity was 4.5 years earlier.
You really didn't dispute the facts, but you still would have no authority to give them.
Well, if we're looking right now at the provision which seems to preclude authority in the IRS.
In terms of claims, the statement in terms of claims. I'm assuming a fact situation which there's no, quote, claim within the meaning of the statute.
Well,
the discovery that we got $7,000, it obviously doesn't belong to us.
That, if we turn to the top of page 4, that is subsection C of the same provision, limit if no claim filed. And that says that you still have to meet the time limits of subsections A and B. So it's very hard to see how the service could feel authorized to make a disbursement of Treasury funds
in this
situation.
If this was not a problem that was noticed by the administration, at least there was a press release at the very time that your cert petition was filed.
That is correct.
In which I believe the president announced that the law must be followed, but this is a very hard situation for people to be in, that they overpaid and they can't get it back. So wasn't it proposed that there be a study of what legislative solution there might be to help people out in this fine?
And that is under study. I know the study is in the Treasury Department.
Well, would you recommend, assuming the facts are, as the petitioner states, as the respondent states them in Brockcamp, the case of the elderly man, would you recommend that the private bill be passed?
Well, I can't. Would I personally recommend it? Yes. Well, I can't say that we faced up to that. What all we have in
because, because I've noticed you've had two of these bills in 34 years, so
there've
apparently
been rather
pretty
few.
Tough on these.
There have been rather few, but these are not instigated by us, after all. They're instigated by the taxpayers if they can get a congressional sponsor.
Well, surely the Justice Department would recommend a private bill in this case, wouldn't
well,
it? Can you speak for
we don't know the facts. We only know what the administrator's affidavit, the daughter's affidavit, said 4 years, more than 4.5 years.
Assume everything's correct. After
the events occurred here. There wasn't any contemporaneous finding about whether this man had the capacity or not. The receipt by the IRS was not an unusual one. Oftentimes, elderly taxpayers have capital gains or other sudden increases in income, and there was no explanation for it. The check merely accompanied an extension of time request. Obviously, the family was in a better position to be monitoring his financial affairs than the Internal Revenue Service was, and could have looked into his bank accounts if they thought at the time that there was lack of capacity. They're now saying 4.5 years later that there was lack of capacity at a time when it's difficult to prove it. And this kind of claim can be made in many cases. I might, as a matter of fact, since we're into the facts, talk a little bit about the facts in the Scott case where there was actually a bench trial. And
Mr. Wallace, may I ask before you do if you can just clarify for me what would be within the universe of possible responses besides a private bill? I suppose what
the administration was looking for was not a private bill, but something maybe akin to the mitigation rules?
There could be something of that sort. It could be temporarily limited. They could expand the time periods upon a showing of certain kinds of incapacity, but they could expand them for only a limited time, because each year you expand it, you're adding another 200 million tax returns that possibly could be reopened at a time when there's talk about downsizing the Internal Revenue Service, and at a time when there are budget constraints. And in order for legislation of this kind to be adopted, Congress needs help in preparing a revenue impact assessment of it. Rather hard to do, since we don't know easily how to estimate how many additional out-of-time refund claims might be stimulated once there were a provision that allowed consideration of the individual circumstances of taxpayers. The service has estimated that it now turns down about 250,000 refund claims a year in whole without examining whether the refund was warranted or not, because they're out of time. But most tax counsel wouldn't file an out-of-time refund claim today on behalf of a client. That figure might increase a great deal. So another possible legislative response to this would be simply to increase the limitations periods, in the hope that more situations such as the alleged situation of Mr. McGill would be caught without having to examine the individual circumstances of individual taxpayers. Just to give their guardians or relatives more time in which to ferret out examples of this kind, which would be much less administratively burdensome. There are all kinds of possibilities, but to date, nothing has been proposed by the administration to the Congress, nor am I. We'll of course inform the court if any action is taken, either on the Hill or by the administration. In the meantime, it must be recognized that the press release that was issued on the premise that the existing law bars such claims, as we think these caps on the refund do, and there's no point in saying that the claim can be allowed for a longer period if you can't get any payment as a result of filing the claim. So read as a whole, the provision is inconsistent with equitable tolling. As the court concluded, the applicable provisions in the Lamps case were. And I do want to emphasize that with respect to an express cap on disbursements from the Treasury, there is no more fitting example of where the traditional rules about waivers of sovereign immunity should be applied. When Congress has explicitly cap the disbursement that is authorized to be made, that cannot be enlarged beyond what the language requires, as the court has said about waivers of sovereign immunity. A court is not in a position to enlarge it on equitable grounds. It's quite different from just a statute of limitations on the filing of the claim itself.
As far as the equity is concerned, do you need to go say anything more than the court did in its decision in the Daum case?
Well, the Daum case really addresses everything that's at issue here. What was asked for in Daum, an expansion of the doctrine of equitable recoupment, was an equitable claim very similar to a tolling claim, and some would refer to it as a tolling claim.
It's a form of a claim for avoidance of the limitations period that isn't as precisely defined a deferral of the limitations period as the ordinary tolling claim, but it's very similar. And we think the Dahlm decision it does have a controlling analysis here, and in particular, it's holding that these provisions concerning tax refund suits must be read in conformity with one another and with all the cross-referencing that's involved here. Let me just talk very briefly about the facts of the Scott case to show what kind of thing we're concerned with here. And in Scott, we proceeded all the way to a bench trial with findings. And some of those findings, which are set forth on pages 44A and 45A, of the appendix to our petition are rather telling here. For one thing...
But the only case we have before us is the Brockamp case, Mr.
No, we have both of them together, Mr. Chief Justice. They were decided as companion cases, and we petitioned in the two cases.
I see.
The Court of Appeals decided to put the Brockamp case forward.
Go ahead.
As one where... perhaps the service's problems were not quite as apparent as they would be in the Scott case from our standpoint. The companion case in Scott involved his 1984 tax liability. What the service knew was that he himself, even though the claim now is incapacity because of alcoholism, he himself had filed in January of 1985 his estimated tax return and payment. His father had done that with his prior installments of estimated tax for 1984. And then through the bench trial proceedings, we were able to find out some facts which the district court has listed on pages 44A and 45A. That in 1984, Scott executed a partnership agreement to operate a retail wine shop. In 1985, he entered into an agreement dissolving the partnership so that he could operate the shop on his own. During the time he operated it, he filed his state sales tax. And he obtained an attorney to represent him on driving under the influence charges in 87 and 88. He opened and closed his retail business every day and paid his utilities and rent. So even on the basis of what we were able to learn through a trial, there was considerable doubt. The district court itself said, without the expert testimony in this case, and I'm reading from finding 21, the court might otherwise find the United States argument somewhat persuasive. Of course, expert testimony is something that doesn't occur until the trial itself.
What was the expert testimony about?
It was about how alcoholism can be incapacitating. But and there were two doctors, one for the government and one for the defense. But obviously, the service would have to be very wary the more a claim of incapacity seems specific only to the capacity to comply with the Internal Revenue laws and leaves the person able to comply with many other laws. The administrative finding in such a case would not be one where the service could easily decide that it was an appropriate occasion for tolling. These are very difficult matters to handle. They're not the kind of green eyeshade investigations of a tax return that service personnel are ordinarily engaged in, nor are the facts easily assembled. No, we're dealing here with a very difficult administrative question, and one that both the administration and Congress may give appropriate consideration to, but they obviously have to tread with caution considering the magnitude of the task that is assigned to the service. If I may, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Very well, Mr. Wallace. Mr. Kluger, we'll hear from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. The government would have us believe that where a disabled taxpayer erroneously overpays his taxes and later, through some miracle, determines that he has overpaid and then seeks his redress, the government would have us believe that Congress intended that that disabled taxpayer should have no redress, even in a case such as this, the Brokamp case, where the erroneous overpayment was a direct result of the taxpayer's disability.
Well, he has redress for 3 years. I mean, there's just a time limit on it, right?
He has no redress because he was disabled throughout the statutory period. That is the fact of this case. He would certainly have a redress if he were, like the rest of us, a competent taxpayer. But throughout the statutory period in 6511, he was disabled. Only through some miracle, his daughter discovered the overpayment following the taxpayer's death. But and the government would have us believe that in this circumstance, not only is there an unfairness, but that, I think the unfairness is perhaps beside the point.
Why should we be tugged by the equities here, and undoubtedly these are hard cases, tugged more by these equities than the court was in the Daum case, which was also a very sympathetic situation?
Specifically, Your Honor, I am not asking the court to be tugged by the equities. I'm specifically saying, the point being, that Congress did not intend, could not intend, that this be the result.
Well, we have a rather elaborate Internal Revenue Code where presumably Congress has revealed its intent in the sections that are dealt with in the briefs.
Yes, that is true. I believe that Congress's intent is revealed, albeit darkly, in Section 6511 itself, in the structure of Section 6511. And it is best, I think, to turn to the operation of this statute. This is a statute of limitations, which is not unique but rare, in that the clock that starts the statute of limitations may only begin to run but for some predicate act that is performed by the taxpayer, whether it is the filing of the return or, in the case of Mr. McGill, cutting a check. Until one of those acts eventuates, the clock never starts to run. Now, it doesn't seem to be that much of an intellectual stretch to assume that if this is a statute of limitations that can only begin to run but for the taxpayer's act, that the taxpayer's act not be the result of his fantasies or his delusions, but be the act of a rational, competent taxpayer. And if I might, to illustrate this point, because the counsel for the government has discussed the possibility of holding hundreds of millions of tax returns open, perhaps indefinitely, if equitable tolling applies. This section 6511A, I submit, contemplates that. If we have someone who does not perform any of these two predicate acts, let us assume didn't in 1962, and let 30 years go by without paying his tax and without filing his return, and then one day walks in and files his return and pays the tax. And then a year later figures that he overpaid and files a refund claim. That is a perfectly timely refund claim under anyone's interpretation of 6511, even though the government will have had to wait 31 years for the return and the check, even though in the litigation to follow, all the facts and circumstances that underlay the tax occurred 31 years ago. That is the way Section 6511
Would you explain how your interpretation of 6511 applied to the particular facts of your case so as to allow your client to prevail?
My client...
You say 6511, you say is the key?
The point I'm making is that the question that I was addressing in answer to Justice Ginsburg's question is, what is there in this statute that leads me to believe that equitable tolling, that this is the type of statute in which equitable tolling might apply. And my answer is that the way that 6511 operates, the statute of limitations, which is what 6511A is, it is a statute of limitations, it can only begin to run after the taxpayer acts.
Would you apply this to the facts of your case?
In our specific case, the statute of limitations on the underlying tax never began to run against Stanley McGill throughout his entire life. The government would have us believe that the statute of limitations on refund claims per 6511 ran out even though the underlying period of limitations against the commissioner to assess a tax never began. We submit that...
Well, I guess the government takes the position that the money that was paid was payment of the tax.
The government...
Isn't that the position the government takes?
If the government had been...
A payment was made.
Yes, I understand that. If the government was consistent in that position, the government would have assessed the tax. In direct answer to your question, Your Honor, I don't believe that that is the position the government takes.
Didn't they put the check in an overpayment fund?
That's correct. They, in fact, did not assess. I don't think that fact is necessarily relevant to the question.
But you still have a statute that says no matter what it was...
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
No matter what it was, the payment was, the statute addresses refund and what... What you want is a refund. So whatever the character of the payment was, the Treasury has it, and you want it back, and so you are suing for a refund.
That is correct.
And this is a rather dense statute, is it not?
This is, Your Honor, if I might answer that question, perhaps at a little bit of length, this is an extremely dense, dark statute.
But it's part of a dense code that does have some provisions for equitable mitigation.
Yes.
And those provisions themselves are remarkably dense. So why would one, given the density of the code, given the density of the mitigation provision, say, but the court, because in other areas there's equitable tolling, ought to apply it here as well?
Your Honor, this is a dense, integrated regime of refund claims. That is true. I feel, however, it is no less dense and integrated than Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which was the grounds for applying equitable tolling in the Irwin decision. In the Irwin decision, we had a procedure for recouping, a procedure for suing on a Title VII case that is really very similar to what we have in the statutory regime for refund claims. We had a situation where an individual goes to his particular agency under the Civil Rights Act. If that claim is denied, he goes to the EEOC, at which point there is a 30-day letter that is sent to the individual. If that is denied, he has the opportunity to sue in federal court. A very similar statutory regime.
It didn't have a substantive limitation as this does. And how do you handle the substantive limitation here? It's not a matter of just getting around it or ignoring it.
Nope,
you have to rewrite it.
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Tell me how your case comes in under B2. How do you qualify under B2?
The direct answer, Your Honor, the way we read B2 is that it is not a substantive limitation. To the extent that amounts are limited in B2, it is as a function of a limitation in time. There are plenty of substantive limitations that exist in the Internal Revenue Code. This isn't one of them. For example, the Internal Revenue Code provides a limitation on the credit you can get against the state taxes. The code says it's limited, $192,800. That is a substantive limitation that is contained in the tax court, in the tax code, and no court can change it to $193,000. That's not what we have here. To the extent that it affects a limitation, it is a limitation that is a function of time. And that time in B2 refers back to the time limitations in 6511A.
Well, but how do you apply B2? If it was filed by the taxpayer during the three-year period prescribed in subsection A, it wasn't, right? So you're not in B2A, right?
We are not in B2A. There was no return filed.
Okay. So you must be in B2B.
Mm-hmm.
Limit where claim not filed within three-year period. If the claim was not filed within such three-year period, the amount of the credit shall not exceed the portion of the tax paid during the 2 years immediately preceding the filing of the claim. Now,
that's
when was your claim filed?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
When was your claim filed?
The claim was filed, I can give you the exact date, Your Honor. The claim was filed in 1991.
There were no taxes paid during the 2 years immediately preceding the filing.
Oh, of course not, Your Honor.
So, I don't understand what you do with B then.
B2B says
you get no money.
But you can say
you ignore it.
I don't wish to ignore it. I suggest that it is amenable to equitable tolling.
You mean you just read right into the very specific provision of B2B some kind of equity principle?
Oh, absolutely. In the same way...
We did. Well, Dom... I mean, Dom refused to do that in a similar situation. Dom was decided just about the same time as Irwin was, which suggests that perhaps you don't go into equitable tolling when you're dealing with something as complicated as the Internal Revenue Code.
Well, I believe that Dom is distinguishable in that the issue of a taxpayer's disability did not arise, number one, and Dom limited the application of an equitable principle. It didn't eliminate the amenability of the tax code to an equitable principle. It limited it. Quite frankly, in the Dom case, the litigant had the ability to litigate the second tax in the tax court and slept on her rights.
But wasn't there some not entirely honorable conduct on the government side in that case in tripping or trapping her?
I don't believe so.
Wasn't there some line in an opinion about how badly the government had behaved?
In the Dom case, I don't recall that at all, Your Honor.
But, Mr. Kluger, that was in any event not the basis on which we decided the case. We didn't decide there is no equity here. We decided there is no equitable tolling here. Equity or not?
No, Your Honor. The Dom case was decided not on equitable tolling, but on equitable recoupment. A different doctrine. Equitable tolling did not come into that case at all.
No equitable alteration of the terms of the code.
Well,
not that there was no equity in the case. I mean, that wasn't the basis for the decision.
Your Honor, after the Dom decision, as I read it, I read that the Dom decision limited this court's prior decision in Bull, but did not overrule it. As I read the Dom decision, we still have a doctrine of equitable recoupment, and the doctrine of equitable recoupment does allow a taxpayer to go and have a set-off against taxes where the period of limitations against that tax did run out.
But why? Why? That is, I'll help you, I think. Maybe I won't. You might not need my help. But the language and complexity doesn't bother me.
Mm-hmm.
It says the claim for refund shall be filed 2 years from the time the tax was paid. 2 years, you say, means 2 years minus time when he's disabled. That's what you're saying, right? 2 years, not counting time when he was disabiled. Isn't that your argument? If you don't want to take that argument, you don't have to. But
I'm not so sure I understand your question.
I thought the tolling principle, you have a statute of limitation. It says file within 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Tolling means file within 3 years, not counting disability time.
Correct, Your Honor.
All right, and you want to read those words in A the same.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you want to read the words 2 years in B shall not exceed the portion of the tax paid during the 2 years immediately preceding to read 2 years, not counting disability time. Isn't that what you're saying?
That is correct.
All right, you started out saying the language is okay, and you started out saying the complexity doesn't matter. It just happens that Congress said the same thing twice and not once. So I'm with you so far that you said the government wants us to read that language not to have tolling.
Correct.
And you're right. But their reason is that they think it would create a total nightmare.
Well,
therefore, Congress couldn't have intended this. And indeed, it's the Internal Revenue Code. Not noted for its charity, perhaps, but not in, and it, you know, it's the government. It's not to private people. And they don't have these green eye shades when they try to investigate whether a person was drunk or not drunk, or disabled or not disabled. So it couldn't be that Congress intended that. I thought you were going to address that argument when you started, and therefore I wanted to give you a chance to address it.
We are certainly not saying, Your Honor, that a disabled taxpayer is exempt from the statutory provisions that are contained in 6511. We only say that those statutory provisions be deferred until such time as a taxpayer, by whatever means, regains his competency.
Yeah, but so, what if he died? In this case, didn't he die without regaining the competency?
That's correct.
And how long after his death was the claim filed?
He died in 1989, and I believe it was filed in 1991. The claim was timely filed.
Within 2 years from his death?
Your Honor, I apologize.
Well, that's crucial because you could not answer Justice Breyer's question yes, as you did. Reading B2B to say 2 years, you know, not including disability time. You'd have to say not including disability time and also not including any time after death. You'd have to say, right, at least his heirs have to do it within 2 years.
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. That is absolutely true.
Well, you said they did it within 2 years here. I thought you said you didn't know.
I am confident that his competent heirs did file a timely claim.
Within 2 years after his death.
What standard do you conclude it was timely? I'm not sure I'm following you.
My memory fails me as to the exact date, Your Honor, but I do recall, and I can represent to the court that was the case, that
but
the claim was
within
timely
2 years of the time that the heirs discovered that the money had been mistakenly paid. Would that be enough? I suppose equitable, too. I don't know why the death is the critical point. It seems to me in most of these doctrines, it's when the claimant discovers the cause of action. If you say he's there's an excusable failure to get the facts sooner. So I don't know why the death is critical.
It's only critical because of the way Justice Breyer put the question. You would have to say no, Justice Breyer, not just disability, but disability
or other
or anything,
anything else that justifies the failure to file,
which makes
file,
it a little hard.
Which is lack of discovery.
It's getting to be a pretty long provision that we're writing here.
Well, that's right. But I'm not sure. Is your theory one of just disability or is it an inability to discover?
We believe that. Consistent with a self-assessment tax regime, that the disability with respect to tolling should be that disability on the part of a taxpayer that inhibits the taxpayer from filing a return.
But why isn't the administrator of the estate or whoever it is doesn't find the records for 2 or 3 years, the administrator was equally disabled. It's not because of a mental disability, it's just because she didn't have the facts. I mean, I'm just not sure that you've got a principle here unless you extend it beyond the period you're relying on.
In fairness to the government, I think that equitable tolling, the grounds on which a court should apply equitable tolling, the disabilities that should qualify is a narrow one because the government does have a legitimate need to...
But not so narrow that it wouldn't include at least alcoholics and people who are senile. Right.
Your Honor, if it's an alcoholic, if it is someone who's senile, the standard should be, was there a disability throughout the statutory period that inhibited the taxpayer from having a
appreciated. You'd have a trial in each case.
Absolutely.
As we see in the case of an alcoholic, some of them can carry on a business and function all right. Others can't function.
That is absolutely correct.
Somebody who's betwixt and between, say, in the first stages of a debilitating disease, there'd be a great variety of much room for trials, right?
I don't think so, Your Honor, for this reason. Mr. Wallace has raised the specter, and they certainly do on their brief, of hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of tax returns that might remain open if this doctrine were permitted in this area. We think that's an exaggeration, to say the least, for this reason. We feel that since 1990, when this court decided the Irwin case, that in fact the floodgates were opened.
But
the numbers
get down so quickly? I mean, they were very close in time, weren't they?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The Down case and the Irwin case.
Yes.
Well, within a year of each other.
Same. Yes, Your Honor.
And so you think that there was such rethinking, a light dawned in Irwin that led to the court in Down having seen the error of its ways. So if that case had come up and the opportunity for equitable tolling had presented itself, they would have been...
Maybe he's claiming alcoholism as a disease.
Inconsistent with what they...
I don't think that Dahm and Irwin are inconsistent with each other. I think they don't have anything to do with each other. They deal with different doctrines. The Irwin decision dealt with equitable tolling. The Dahm decision dealt with equitable recoupment and did not...
No, but there's another distinction that you can make. You can take the position that Justice Scalia did and say, let's bring everything under the umbrella of equitable adjustment. And then there are still distinctions between the cases. And the one is, Title VII case was dealing with a situation in which the government is often in the position of a private individual who normally gets the benefit of equitable tolling. Whereas in the revenue situation, the government is in a position peculiar unto itself. So those would be good reasons to say that there's no reason to think that that there would be a spillover over of equitable considerations from a Title VII case to a revenue case. And that seems to me to make more sense of the fact that these two cases came down in the same term, in which it would be very odd to think that one was being undercut by the other so soon.
Well, I don't think that one undercut another. The Irwin decision did not mention the Dahm case, nor do I expect that it would. But in the Irwin decision, from what I have read, the briefs in that case and the argument in that case did not mention Dahm. I have to presume that...
Dahm was decided after Irwin, wasn't it?
No, the
Irwin was after, a few months after, I think.
Correct. I assume that the reason that the Irwin decision does not mention Dahm, or that the briefs in that decision don't mention Dahm, or that the Dahm was not argued at Irwin, was that the two cases just don't have anything to do with each other. They're on different principles.
The different principles being equitable tolling versus equitable
recoupment.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But if we don't accept that distinction, doesn't the remaining distinction, in other words, if we generalize equity, then aren't you faced with the fact that the Title VII considerations would not normally be applicable to a revenue case?
Correct. Your Honor, if this court decides that Dahm applies in equitable tolling to the same extent that it applies to equitable recoupment, I have a problem. That certainly is true.
In fact, isn't it true that in the Dahm case, that was at least some of us thought that the government was guilty of inequitable conduct? And here you don't have any claim of inequitable conduct against the government. In a sense, the government's case is perhaps stronger here than it was in Dahm.
I will admit, Your Honor, I did not read the Dahm decision.
You probably didn't read the dissent then, I guess.
Uh-huh. Oh, indeed I did, Your Honor. And I noted that the dissenter in that case indicated that this was a case that would have very narrow applicability. I'm surprised that, I was surprised that the government would seek to pump up Dahm into something that...
Well, do you think the government is bound by the dissent's view of the opinion in Dahm?
No, of course not. Of course not. My point is that Dahm should not apply because it applies to a different doctrine.
But I am correct, am I not, that you are not accusing the government of inequitable conduct in this case?
Oh, absolutely not. No. In the brief time remaining...
I think that in the mitigation rules, there is some element of the government having taken an inconsistent provision, and then it seems to be that you have to have that much. Am I not right that where the government describes it in its brief, the mitigation provisions apply to problems that exist when the party that asserts the statute of limitations, and the only one who would assert it would be the government, had prior to the running of the statute taken a position inconsistent with its current position?
That is correct. The government has an inference from the existence of the mitigation provisions that these provisions should be exclusive, that the mitigation provisions, which are statutory, are the only...
Yeah, but maybe what they're saying is that the government, that Congress was so strict in allowing any mitigation at all. So the notion that they meant it when they didn't say it is a little hard to accept.
I'm afraid I don't understand the thrust of your question. The mitigation provisions is a statutory provision.
Right.
It was, from my reading, enacted because equitable recoupment, the cases were going all over the place, and so Congress felt that they should bring some order to this doctrine of equitable recoupment. And so they enacted the mitigation provisions. They are very, very narrow provisions. They arise in only the rarest circumstances. But I think the existence of the mitigation provisions, the statutory mitigation provisions, proves one point, which is that if you have a statutory mitigation provision in the tax code, it doesn't necessarily mean that you cannot have an equitable overlay, because we still do have an equitable overlay, and that equitable overlay is the doctrine of equitable recoupment, which exists side by side with the mitigation provisions of the tax code. Those provisions...
Wouldn't it totally eclipse what's in the code if you could just say, I don't want to deal with that dense stuff, it's so narrow and so technical. Give me equitable tolling writ large.
No, Your Honor. Equitable recoupment applies in a very, very narrow area. It certainly is not limited to incompetent taxpayers. You don't have your choice. It's not like a cafeteria. You don't get equitable recoupment or equitable tolling. Equitable recoupment only can arise when the taxpayer is called upon to pay the same tax twice under different theories. That's equitable recoupment. Equitable tolling is a completely different doctrine. It reminds me of what Mark Twain said about fires and fireflies. You know, they may sound alike, but
Be more responsive to getting back a tax paid once than a tax paid twice?
Again, Your Honor, two different doctrines here.
You are making equity your plea, right?
That's correct.
Different situations where one might be drawn by the equities of the situation. Because even in administering a system of equity, you have to have a rational basis.
Yes, Your Honor. The equities, I submit, are stronger in this case than they were, for example, in Dahm. In Dahm, may I complete?
Yes, finish
in
your
Dahm,
Justice.
In Dahm, the taxpayer had the ability to litigate the case. In our case, we never had the ability. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Kluger. Mr. Wallace, you have 5 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. In Irwin, the court recognized that waivers of sovereign immunity must be unequivocally expressed, and then said that once Congress has made such a waiver, we think that the rule of equitable tolling should be applicable to suits against the government in the same way as to suits against private defendants, and that amounts to little, if any, broadening of the congressional waiver. That rationale applies to
tolling of the limitations for filing suit or for filing claims. It really is not addressed to the obstacle here, which is a substantive limitation, a cap that Congress has imposed on the amount of the refund that's authorized to be dispersed from the federal treasury. And as I pointed out earlier, therefore, it would require a broadening of a waiver of sovereign immunity beyond the express terms of the waiver to rule that a court may override this cap. In the very sensitive area of disbursements from the Treasury, the area that is most related to the constitutional underpinnings of the doctrine of sovereign immunity itself, including the provision we have pointed to in the Constitution in Article 1, Section 9, Clause 7, that no money shall be drawn from the Treasury but in consequence of appropriations made by law. Now, it is the fact that in Webb, the Fourth Circuit suggested some ways of reading the rebuttable presumption in Irwin more narrowly. And we have done the same thing in a pending petition and reply brief in a case called United States against Batum involving the Quiet Title Act, which we have suggested that the court hold for the decision in this case. But I think that these suggestions are well worthy of consideration, and the court in Webb at the conclusion of its opinion pointed out some other areas involving other federal statutes where various courts have held that the rebuttable presumption has been overcome, even if the presumption of Irwin does apply. But in this particular case, we're really beyond the area where it's just a limitation on the filing of the claim that's at issue. The court has no further
questions. Is a claim filed under the statute when the taxpayer just gives the notice to the Internal Revenue Service, or is a claim filed when there's a refund suit filed? I think it's the former, is it not? How do you file a claim?
It's a claim to the service. There's a separate provision involving limitations on filing the suit, and that has to be within 2 years after the disallowance of the claim. That is Section 6532A1 of Title 26.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace. The case is submitted.